You're listening to an M Pavilion podcast. We acknowledge the people of the Eastern Kulin Nation as the traditional custodians of the land on which M Pavilion stands. We pay our respects to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to the traditional custodians of the land where you're tuning in from, around Australia and across the globe.
Hi everybody, I'm Bradley Kerr. I'm a Quandamooka man from Indiraba. And I normally start these by telling you all that I have a lot of fear and anxiety at doing public speaking, but I've been told that I'm not allowed to say that anymore, so this is me not saying it. I'd also just start by saying that, this is a really kind of exciting topic that I'm looking forward to leaning on our three incredible panellists for. For full transparency, I'm in a very strange space at the moment, emotionally. And I think a lot of Indigenous people have experienced a tough year this year. The purpose of this event is to hold space for First Nations perspectives and worldviews and explore how we can make systemic change in a culturally safe environment. This panel was brought together out of conversations with elders around the role that water plays. And as one of the elders so eloquently determined, water lines are like the bloodlines of country. When we treat our body poorly, we suffer. And when we treat our rivers and water systems poorly, our ecology and ecosystems suffer. As I introduced myself as a Quandamooka man from Mjeraba, the Quandamooka peoples are the people of the bay. Our reciprocal relationship with water stretches back time immemorial. So long that I grew up assuming that people must be able to swim in the Birrarung, in Merri Creek, and in all of the inner city waterways. And how could it be so otherwise, that such a significant body of water could not be celebrated and could not be honoured and treated with respect? How could we not ensure health of our water systems? How have we turned our backs to waterways? Our industry's primary function is to shape and modify place. We know that we are always building on somebody's country, and we have a responsibility as design practitioners to work with country and its traditional owners. Slowly starting to learn more about the true histories of our country, and that a purposeful ignorance to the architecture of country helped inform Terra Nullius. Our sophisticated understanding of place, of narrative landscapes, and mnemonic memory through song, dance, and storytelling were ignored and dismissed. Landscapes made way for colonial farming. Cadastral maps sliced country and our cities turned backs to the waters, using them as dumping grounds. I think that in part this culture of erasure enabled the Australian dream. So, where do we go? Sitting with me today are three professionals in related industries who will explore the agency and personhood rights of water bodies as living ecosystems and explore how these ideas can inform culturally responsive design and urban planning. On my right, we've got Jack Mitchell. Jack is a Whadjuk Noongar designer and artist working on his PhD, and he's exploring cultural relationships with water. Next along, we've got Kaylee Salvatore. Kaylee Salvatore is a Yuin Barawang woman living and working on Gundagarag Darug country. Kaylee is a founding director of Kola Studio. Kaylee's a landscape architect and Indigenous design strategist. Her work advocates for environmental justice and seeks to design with cultural sensitivity and respect. Kaylee is a regular contributor to industry journals, guest speaker at industry events, and guest educator for tertiary institutions, as well as holding a board member position at Greater Sydney Parklands Trust. And on the end, we have Scott Adams, is a director at TCL's Melbourne studio and has led the design documentation teams on some of the firm's largest urban and civil projects. His involvement in the design of Birrarung Ma saw the inclusion of significant native planting and contemporary landscape design to create the largest new park in Melbourne CBD. So I've just said a whole bunch of stuff, and I don't really know if I've said much at all. I'm hoping that you, as an introduction, would like to explain a little bit more about what you do and why you feel like this topic is so valuable.
Sure. It's been a while since someone's described me as a professional. I'm not sure I agree with that in any sense, but Why this topic is important, I guess, because water is everything. You know, we are water. We are bodies of water. And we rely on water, fresh water, to survive, as does everything else that, you know, lives and flourishes. And I think culturally how we relate to water is, to me, is the primary indicator of how of a healthy society is, whether we are, it's a microcosm of our cultural values. You know, how we treat the thing that we are reliant on to live and exist is a reflection of the gratitude that we have for being here, and the custodial kind of nature that we have, that we should have, but maybe don't in some cases.
When we're looking at water in design, we start off with country, and we predominantly work in Darug country, which is in Darawal country in Sydney. Saltwater, freshwater country, we've got this story where freshwater is making its way out to the sea, which is generally what happens. But it has also shaped the land, whether that's through these rugged erosion patterns that have created the topography that we know of the sandstone cliffs of Sydney, or whether it's the lazy meandering rivers that have created these beautiful rolling golden hills of the Darug, Western Sydney sort of plains. We pretty much look at the ways in which water shapes place, its role as creator and knowledge holder, to kind of understand the character, to understand the identity, the cultural protocols of place as well. Generally, as people traditionally, we identify ourselves by the type of water in which we're connected to. So I'm a saltwater Buduang woman. and so that role that water plays in identity extends not from not only to country, but also all the way to the self as well. It plays a role in the character, the type of vegetation that you see as well. So throughout our design process, we're always looking at water, and that can come in a myriad of ways, whether it's emulating the way water moves through space to think about how we might treat circulation, whether it's cascading, meandering, pooling, slowing, moments of turbulence. We also look at the health of water, our reciprocal relationships to water, as well as with designing place. Often we're looking at waterways that are degraded and polluted. So we think about, well, how can we practice custodianship and reciprocity and give back to these waterways and acknowledge their right to be healthy as well. As a start, I don't want to take up too much time, so I'll pass it over.
Thank you. Just by background, before I became a landscape architect, I studied science, and I was interested in human sciences. I studied anatomy and physiology, and then after a period of time, I shifted into environmental sciences. And what I noticed was I couldn't help but see the parallels between human systems and environmental systems, and then went on to study landscape architecture. And so, having been practicing for now almost 30 years, I look back, and when I first started practicing, I did it in a very scientific manner. I saw the qualities of water and how it could be improved. I saw the ways that the negative impact of simply a pit and pipe solution that a traditional engineer would approach to dealing with stormwater could be reversed, and we could bring water back to the surface. It could be something that you celebrate, make something beautiful within a park. It can be something that we can treat and then improve the water quality and improve the bigger environment. But it probably really wasn't until the last 10 years and being fortunate to talk with a number of traditional owners about the cultural value of water and realising that there isn't this binary opposite between science and culture, that actually it is one thing, and that there is this sort of a notion of a reciprocal relationship between people and a landscape rather than people being separate to the landscape. And I think that's something I try and look at and work with in when engaging with traditional owners now on large projects, and particularly dealing with water.
Jack, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about your PhD. I know you've just recently hit a bit of a milestone with it.
Yep, I did confirmation on Friday. Thank you. The PhD started in 2018. Well, it wasn't a PhD then. It was a project called Black, White and Blue Space, which it still is called, but it was looking at cultural relationships to water. And it was a six-month grant project from Creative Victoria, looking at investigating cultural relationships to water to understand how better knowledge around how we sort of think about, feel, relate to water can better foster better built environment outcomes. I was sort of more, I guess, looking at it from more of a design perspective then, and I've sort of shifted away a little bit from that. And that was a series of conversations and yarns with elders and knowledge holders on Whadjuk country, Lake Mungo, here on Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung country. And then, so that sort of was the momentum that sort of guided. I mean, I have a history with the water of Whadjuk country, like I think everyone does. And you mentioned the salt and freshwater separation, which was also once the case on the Derbal Yerrigan, where it met the down at Walyalup, and it met the salt water, the fresh water that came down there. It used to be separated by a limestone embankment. And I have a generational, on both my Indigenous and non-Indigenous side, generational connections to the industrial processes that destroyed that separation. There was an engineer called C.Y. O'Connor, who was an Irish engineer who was employed by the government when the gold was discovered in Kalgoorlie, headhunted. He was working in New Zealand, and they brought him out to basically build the railroad, dredge the harbour. And he built I don't know if anyone knows this story, but he built the Mundaring Weir, so dammed the weir at the top of the Derbal Yerrigan, and blew up the limestone embankment, which was sacred to Whadjuk Noongar people, because we used to live in six-season cycles, moving across the landscape, hunting and fishing, and moving to the different places according to resource availability, and following song lines. And then Uncle Noel Nanup describes that as a spiritual flow, which is all to do with water. So it's the water that, that evaporates and it comes down and it fills up, what used to be called Borloo was a connection, a series of wetlands that all became one wetland as it filled up when the rains came. And then that would, turtles and fish and birds would breed and move around in their migratory patterns, and then the water would build up at this limestone embankment that separated, that stopped at the salt water. And there would be a big mullet harvest or fish, they'd come in and use the river dolphins to help shepherd the fish into the shallows and spear a whole bunch of fish. And that was hugely important to vitamin D intake and the nutrients of the whole whole community. And then C.Y. O'Connor came in and he blew up the embankment to separate that separated that salt and fresh water, dredged the harbour, dammed the weir, and then built this pipeline that went 500 kilometres out to Kalgoorlie to pipe all the water out to the goldfields. And the person who I started Black, White and Blue Space with, his great-great-great-grandfather was C.Y. O'Connor. And my great-great-great-grandfather on my mum's side died in one of the explosions when they were dredging that harbour or blowing up the limestone embankment and quarrying the limestone. And the typical story that people hear, young Western Australian kids, is that C.Y. O'Connor ended up committing suicide because he basically became depressed because the pipeline wasn't working and everyone was very doubtful and the media were kind of out to get him. But the Noongar story is that they sung him, and so all the elders across the southwest and along the countries all the way out to the goldfields were just like, no, that's, you've done too much damage as one person to interrupt the entire sacred flow of life for our people, where bloodlines of country, like our blood that moves through hearts for generations upon generations, and that babies are birthed, are gestated in that in water and tears and everything that is like the emotional life and the sacred life of a culture has been destroyed in this very brief period by this one guy. And Uncle Noel's very forgiving when he talks about him. He only talks about C.Y. O'Connor as someone who has, you know, amazing feats of engineering, which is, you know, simultaneously true in a way. And I'm, you know, and that's, you know, my ancestry, my Wadjuk Noongar ancestry is there. My elders would have been a part of that process. And so I feel very, you know, that's like the task for me feels like the work of doing this kind of repairing cultural relationships to water is about getting back to right relationship with country and doing healing. And it's a form of like we talk about intergenerational trauma, but that trauma is also directly linked to the trauma of land and to the trauma of water and, you know, terrestrial and aquatic trauma. So to me, doing work in trying to repair those relationships to water is a work of repairing intergenerational trauma and healing. And I'm doing that as well over here, working with Auntie Carolyn on a project, an ARC linkage project called Repairing Memory and Place, with a team from Monash. So, yeah, lucky to be able to do that on Boonwurrung country too.
I was just going to say it was a really poignant story, and I think something to recognise is that that disruption is ongoing. It's still happening. And for many, many communities, it's akin to a genocide of culture, of even being able to fish in your rivers, to be able to connect with your rivers. I mean, what's been happening to the Murray-Darling and the way that that has been farmed and dredged and depleted is horrible, and it's ongoing. It's not something that's just happened in the past. It's still something that's happening now. And same thing in Western Sydney as well, in Darug country, in Darug Noora. We have these beautiful plains that are filled with all these pockets of water, ephemerally. When you look at it on a map, it's just a patchwork of all of these little ponds. And Auntie Cindy Laws and Uncle Greg Sims say that, you know, these are the capillaries or the lungs of country, and they connect through the Waianamata, which essentially means the birth waters or the mother waters. And so you've got all this history of women's waters being connected to these places as they birth, and a cultural mentor of mine, Clarence, really poignantly said, you know, be careful how you treat this place and how you tread on this place, because so many women's waters have broken here. And but this place is up for rampant urbanisation, and it's getting flattened and turned into a city, and those waterways aren't going to really exist. They're going to be channeled, and they're going to be engineered into pipes. And I just, it really, I know that these things are ongoing, but hearing to your story just really hits home at how much it's still happening. Yeah.
And it also happened here in Melbourne. If you read the historical records, they talk about when they drained the swamps of South Bank to create, which is the art centre and the whole section of land down through there. It was written it was described as the Kakadu of the South. It was so rich with bird life and food. And around the same time, they also blew the falls up, the falls which would have been at Sandridge Bridge. I'm fortunate to be working with Sarah Rees, myself and a team of landscape architects from Aspect and TCL are working with the City of Melbourne there's a project called the Green Line, where they're trying to renaturalise the northern bank of the Yarra River for 4 kilometres from Birung Ma down to the end of Collins Wharf. And Sarah's been leading the engagement with Rundri. But the aim is in a way to create a counterpoint to what's happened in the past, but also what exists currently on South Bank itself is just a concrete edge. There's nothing ecological about it. And our connection to the river is not simply just being able to be able to contact the water, but be able to be in touch with the ecology of the water and to try and foster and bring that ecology back, and to bring an awareness that probably not a lot of people realise. There was a creek that ran down Elizabeth Street and another one that ran down William Street, and three that run currently under Flinders Street Station. and all of those exit out through brick vaults into the river, and it's all sort of hidden under concrete, and how we can sort of bring an awareness back to that, but also bring back the ecology that theoretically it can still support.
Yeah, I think one of the things you said about, like, that it's still happening now, and, you know, you're talking about the things that happened in the past, I think that, like, distinction is also important to sort of not separate, in terms of, like, we live in the resonance of those things that happened before, and it's like the sort of symphonic vibratory field that we live in is like very jarring and very kind of constant, and that is like, you said it's akin to genocide. It is genocide, and you know, even according to the United Nations kind of like definition of genocide, intentionally bringing about the destruction of people. It's not that you actually have to be direct about it. You're destroying the way that, like, people's way of life. Then you sort of, and I think the changes, like making changes to that, and, you know, moving through that kind of like, moving through the emotion of that and moving through the grief of that, but also, you know, fighting for, you know, justice and reparations of that is an ongoing thing, and very, yeah, it's hard to communicate, I think, sometimes, like how, like what that is, and sometimes it's hard to sort of even feel it ourselves. I think there's a relationship, I think, between like the cult, you know, and that's why I think the cultural relationship is important, because we can continue to like do things and do projects which are, you know, important, and shifting those projects in directions that are sort of more aligned with those values of, you know, of healing and repair and custodial nature and looking after the places that that we rely on to exist. But I think that we're not going to make the right cultural changes until we feel and move through those like emotional changes as well. I was up in Darwin last year and met some crew from Arnhem Land, and they were talking that there's people up there talking about how all the problems of the world, well, you know, according to them, is it comes down to the blockages in the flow of the world's water, and the flow of the world's water also being relation, like the blockages in the flow of our own water, and whether that's like how we relate to, you know, to birthing sites or birth itself, and how the sacredness of that and how we uphold that, but the grief as well. So that flow of like water in our own bodies and in our own like way that we relate, and yeah, you know, country is a reflection of that.
It's interesting you mentioned that. There was a few years ago I was involved in a project up near Benalla. It was called Lake McCowan, or Winton Lake. So in 1971, the Murray Goulburn Authority decided to dam this valley. It was a very shallow valley, so the weir wall was about 10 metres high, and they created a series of natural swamps into one 5,000 square kilometre lake, and then they sold it off as irrigation licences. And so they destroyed the corroboree land of the Yorta Yorta, but then they also destroyed the township, and then they realised in 2010, there wasn't enough flow going to the Murray, so they decommissioned the dam and let the water flow back. And we worked to do a business case and looking at it as landscape architects to understand how do you undo this, because the state didn't want the land, and they set up a Crown Land Management Trust because everyone put it in the too hard basket. And we were fortunate to work with the Yorta Yorta and come up with an agreement where they could have direct input and ongoing management of the land. But it just caused so much damage in the cultural damage it did to the Yorta Yorta, but then also the cultural damage to people you met in the town who'd lived there since the 1950s and 60s, who'd lost all their childhood, had been underwater for 50 years. Yeah. And then the damage of trying to undo, or how do you fix a landscape that's been underwater for 50 years, and working with ecologists and obviously Yorta Yorta to work out strategies to bring that back. But it's been a successful process, but it's been a very painful process.
It's a lot of undoing here. I feel like I could talk about how water influences design, but I feel like the conversation kind of is going to this place where you're really considering whether the paradigms of development and design and care for water cohesive. I often don't feel like they are, you know. I haven't really been involved in very many projects where the outcomes for water have been all fantastic. You know, we try. I mean, obviously we try. We try to clear the water through as many means as which we can, but when you're working in, say, a master plan for the development of a big site, it's usually engineered out of place. I wonder whether you think that the paradigms are even, you know, cohesive.
I don't. That's why I stopped doing architecture.
But I think it's a valid point, and you can't solve all the world's problems within in a city or on a small site. But if you make it prevalent and you make people understand it and people see it, then maybe the power of them seeing and learning from that small example has a bigger effect somewhere else, as opposed to trying to solve it all on your site. So by exposing people to urban ecology and making them appreciate and understand and connect with nature, it has a ripple on effect to how they behave or, you know, how they then engage with nature.
I think the nature culture human nature divide is also something that, you know, needs to shift, because that separation is obviously what sort of, you know, and then I think there's cultural, you know, the changes have to be cultural, and that's in within us and with communities and groups of people and how we actually relate. And a lot of the time we, I mean, maybe not pay lip service, but we might have concepts or ideas or read books about these ways of being and relating, but until those are actually felt and felt in bodies and felt in hearts and felt in ways that can be seen. And so that's like, it's like to return to an actual sort of felt embodied understanding of what is sacred, then we're not going to be motivated to actually live in that way and sort of like look after it. And I think a lot of the time with architecture, with development, especially in Australia, you know, we still are very much in the kind of, you know, the sort of the DNA of this country of Australia is very much like it's here to steal resources and, you know, build a prison and make money and profit and development. And that's so almost all the architectural project that we're doing, you know, obviously there's a lot of scope within that, but for the most part, the motivation for developers and the motivation for sort of like new buildings and, you know, just even the city itself is a very disharmonious and sort of damaging sort of archetype of like a way of living. And I don't think that's necessarily to paint anyone as the kind of anyone or anything as the particular kind of like villain or source of it. It's just like that. It's populated by people, and people who don't like these institutions and these motivations are populated by people and people who don't know how to relate to this place, and it's slow change.
And have also been taught that feelings don't really have a place in decision making, and that you've got to use everything with your rational mind and make your decisions based on a suite of, I guess, numbers or outcomes that don't always include, well, often don't include a set of values and wants and outcomes that are outside of a Western objective. And we often get taught that our feelings don't really have a place, but emotions are a huge driver in telling us what is the right outcome for a place.
How do we know what's good if we can't feel it?
I think on that I might just mention I was really fortunate to meet Jifa Greenway, an Indigenous architect. I met Jifa, who practices in Melbourne, but is from New South Wales. We met in 2019 and we started working together on an infrastructure project, the North East Link. And we were working with a team of 300 engineers, Italians, Germans, Chinese and South Koreans, all specialising in building the tunnel. And they're all exactly that, working around numbers, trying to work out how to do it as fast and as cheap as possible. And we had a number of engagements with Wurundjeri, and for me it was a bit of an eye-opener in this idea I guess it wasn't so much of an eye-opener in this idea of caring for country or having a reciprocal relationship with country, but how do you apply that to a freeway? And it was the conversations I had with Jifa over about 3 months, where you know he rightly pointed out that this way of thinking, it's not the thinking of the past, it's past, present and future, and that there's an inseparable relationship between people and a landscape. And a landscape is not just a tree or a river, it's also the road, it's the bridge we build, it's the house we live in, and we all drive cars, we all have mobile phones, we're all going to get around. So we put forward this proposition back because the engineers had nothing really guiding them as to why they were designing the freeway the way or what was leading their design decision, their thinking. And we sort of put it back to them. Well, actually, we didn't put it back to them. We went to the government architect and said, we think this build, the design should be the design of the road, the bridges, the noise walls, all the water treatment systems should be based on the principles of caring for country and connecting to country. And that it's about Indigenous thinking, not about how it looks. It's about how we've thought about how we've designed it to build it. And we went then and presented back to the engineers and said, this is what we've told the government architect. And the government architect said, yes. And all the Italian engineers said, what? And we explained, well, if you're building a bridge, how do you minimise the amount of concrete, minimise the amount of steel, minimise the footprint that it sits on the ground? How is it that the experience of that bridge is really memorable for the motorist and for the pedestrian, that it connects you where you are on your journey and that it's just this contemporary way of thinking about how do you care for country and connect for country, even if you're building infrastructure. And it did lead to a better design outcome.
It's a challenging proposition on an infrastructure project that, yeah, that I'm getting first-hand experience of. A couple of things. Firstly, if we don't make decisions based on emotions, then I'm fucked because I don't know how to make decisions otherwise. Very emotional person. And I guess to something that you're talking about, just this idea of the continued commodification of country. It's like as an Indigenous architect and designers and in this space, we're kind of constantly in this state of unease and unrest. We know that what we're proposing and what we're building in some ways depends on the continued commodification of country. So how do we challenge that? And I'm not sure if I have the answer, but I was just hoping to kind of put that out there.
I found that I prefer the unstitching jobs as opposed to the greenfield type jobs, I suppose. And, you know, I've been involved in all different kinds, but I really like either their community led jobs where it's the community wanting to make space and changes on land that they've got to be able to tell their story, to provide for community, to, you know, practice culture and the like. Or it's unstitching jobs in urban places. One of the first projects that I was able to be a part of was the South Eveleigh Cultural Gardens. And that was turning a patch of Victorian-era lawn into a beautifully biodiverse little piece of bushland. And, you know, now we've got lizards and butterflies and all sorts of creatures coming back. I mean, it's not that much to do with water, but there's obviously water is there and plays a vital role within that space. But I think that I've just found that, yeah, this kind of unstitching jobs are where you can have the most positive effect.
I'm wondering, when we were having a chat on Friday, you mentioned a particular project in Perth. I was wondering if you'd feel comfortable sharing that story.
I'll try. The story I'm about to tell you is important, not about the quality, like the chemical quality water or the environmental quality of the water, but it's about the cultural value of water and the cultural value and the long-term memory of water. And I might be a little bit out of my depth because this is a Noongar story and I'm not Noongar. I'm Scottish. But look, I was working in Western Australia around 2016, 2017, on the redevelopment of Scarborough Foreshore. Scarborough Foreshore was Big Beach. State government was injecting $100 million to upgrade the whole precinct. New surf club, new outdoor pool, reconfiguring of roads, better pedestrian connection into the beach, and then enabling the beach as a real venue and a place where people would gather. There was a need for a playground we saw in the area, so there was lack of kids playing. We wanted the foreshore to be inclusive for everybody. Age doesn't matter who you are or where you're from, it needs to be inclusive. At the time, there'd been an incident, actually that's an understatement. MH17 flight was shot down over Russia, and a family in Scarborough lost their three kids and their father. So Grandpa was bringing the kids home, Mo, Otis and Jamie, and they were all killed over Ukraine. And the family had a strong connection with Scarborough. They lived in Scarborough. They did a lot of community work. The local government and through the state said, look, we really would like it if somewhere you could acknowledge their loss within the design of the public realm, but they don't want a memorial. So how do you memorialise that loss without a memorial? And it was around the time also that I was talking to some representatives of the Noongar, the Whadjuk Working Group, which was set up to consult to the MRA, the Redevelopment Authority. And they shared a few stories with me. And I asked them, what would you like to see in this public space? And they told me one story. They told me the story about the whale and about how their ancestors had a memory of how the water had risen and Rottnest Island had been cut off and people had been lost and children had drowned. And they had a belief that the whale could bring the souls of the dead back to the shore, that every time a whale was calved, a child's soul would be within it, and then when the whale would wash up on the shore, they'd cut it open, release the blood, and the child would come back out. And so we sort of put two and two together and thought, well, what if we built a playground and made it like a giant whale? And we'll make it the whale skeleton out of precast. Its tail could hold a big swing. Its head would be a slide. We can mount nets off it and all this really fun stuff for kids to play on. And I met with the Maslin family, the mum and dad, and said, if Noongar believe that the whale can bring a child's soul back to the shore, would you feel comfortable if this is what brings your kids back? And so they, in a way, they got their memorial without a plaque on it, without really anyone knowing, except now you all know. But we asked permission. They had a little sketchbook of Otis and Moe's drawings, and we got the fabricator, the artist, to have those engraved on the inside ribs. So when kids run around this playground, they can see the sketches of Moe and Otis. So I thought it was pertinent about a way that, you know, one culture's story can address another culture's need.
Yeah, I think, was that Noel telling that story? No. Yeah. I think that's probably a good place to talk about, I guess, other ways that we can sort of like within architecture kind of, you know, I mean, it's a gesture, it's a nice gesture and someone who lives there, but I think, I think there's obviously things going on in the world at the moment that need to be, you know, I think when we're talking about sort of water and bloodlines of country and water rights and Indigenous people and ways of living and being and relating to sort of institutions, development, government, whether that's firms or and within architecture and design, I think that, you know, a way that, you know, there could be more unequivocal support and overt support for what's happening in Palestine and criticism of the Israeli Zionist state and the mass murder of children. You know, that's a nice thing to, you know, there's thousands and thousands of children dying at the moment and our government is overtly supporting that. I think as architects and as anyone, as Indigenous people and as architects and designers who are responding to these kind of issues on our own country and our own places and here in relationship to water and place, then we should be, you know, overt and unequivocal in us in where we stand on that issue. As you know, I'm not sure what playground you'd build to justify it, but...
as an Aboriginal woman, I as well want to firmly state my support and solidarity for the Palestinian people. I can't understand or fathom, and I kind of can actually, but it's horrible. I don't see it every day coming up. And, you know, I'm with you and support your statement as well.
And I think it's related to the conversations that we're having around water and the, you know, build-up of grief and trauma that happens in bodies and cultures over time when it comes to sort of, you know, empire and colonization that's gone back a long way, and that's continuing. And it's hard to do, you know, when we're talking about doing healing and, you know, reconnecting to waterways and country, when the, you know, the overarching institution of that, you know, the false institution that sort of like runs and manages ultimately anything that happens here is supporting that, or and not criticizing it. So I think that's like the number one priority, you know.
We're heading towards the end of the session. I just wanted to ask each of you if there was something in particular you wanted to see, if there's something in particular you wanted to see change in the future that relates to some of the topics that we've been discussing, or are there any projects in particular that you're working towards to encourage and enable the type of systemic change that's necessary to manage some of these pretty hard topics?
Sure. I suppose I think most of us would agree that water is essential to our health and our life and, you know, the existence of every living thing on the planet. But I think if we can move beyond understanding water as just a necessary material to be consumed for existence and understand its importance in relation to cultural identity, history, connections between ancestors and descendants, and yours as well, not just Indigenous peoples. You know, it's something that binds us to each other, to the land. It's something that is important for our emotional well-being as well. I think if we can look beyond it as this abiotic medium and understanding it as having a right, as having a place and having a role that, you know, has thousands and thousands, millions of years of history since the beginning of time and has crafted these places, I think then we can start to design with a bit more respect on how these waterways are treated and how they're managed. I think that's, if we can look beyond it as that, then that will have some real positive change. But also, I guess, to come back to some of my negativity earlier as well, I think, you know, it's also understanding that repairing and ecological stewardship is something that is probably going to take another 200 years. We've got 200 years of damage and undoing, and it would likely take 200 years of doing better. So it's an intergenerational thing. And it's, you know, I might get a bit upset about the present state of things, but I think if we are positive, we will see positive change, and we have seen positive change. So,
Well, I guess what I'd like to see is, I'll talk by example. If you live out in the eastern suburbs, which I don't, but I'm just happening to be working there, the water that comes down Kurnung Creek flows through three different city shires before it goes into the Yarra, where it goes through two more city shires, and then that goes out in the bay. And in that, it goes through three government departments of responsibility, but each one of them don't take the full responsibility because it's kind of like it's easy to put it onto the next party, or there's no sort of one overall view. And that's just describing what happens in Melbourne, let alone what happens in the globe in terms of a global sense about the way we treat water. So I'd love to see governments acting more collaboratively, even with their own internal government departments, to actually follow one policy rather than just sort of side shuffling it onto the next party. But then in doing that also is in engagement with traditional owners, that the outcome is not simply a pattern or an artwork, but actually the way of thinking and management to actually achieve that, which they can't seem to do across their own boundaries.
Yeah, those cultural changes within institutions, like how do you actually sort of implement cultural changes so that the so that those things are sort of like felt and understood outside of just, you know, continuing on. In the project that I'm working on with the ARC linkage with the team at Monash, one of the I think that maybe Melbourne Water people, those, you know, the, one of the questions that we're working on is their engineers were like, okay, well, how do we implement Indigenous water knowledge into our, you know, they've been trained as engineers and they're, you know, completely entrenched in this kind of like mode, and you're trying to tell people that like water is a living entity and has rights. And for them, they're like, oh, yeah, cool, that's a nice, like, thought, or it's a nice idea, it's a nice metaphor, it's a nice belief. But to actually see and feel and understand that as a true thing, as, like, that agency, that it's not, we're not human-centric, and that, like, agency and rights are things that we participate in with country and with water. But I don't think that's hard to implement. And I think it's ceremony and ritual, that like all the ceremonies and rituals that we participate in, which kind of like guide and direct our cultures and our cultural values, are like the things that we need to sort of make those adjustments and changes on. I'm not really sure exactly how to do that, but I'll tell you in a couple of years when I finish my PhD. But I just wanted to, I think talking about cultural change, there's a story that I heard from the desert from someone who was doing a PhD out there years ago, and they shared this story when they were looking at cultural ways of relating to water, and I think it highlights it quite neatly, is, and the difference in the kind of the two cultural value systems that we, well, not that there's only two of them, but like predominantly. And it was a group of people in the Western, I think in like the maybe East Max, but in the central desert somewhere, I can't remember whose country exactly, but they're looking at this idea of water seepage and why there was this like sickness that people were getting from drinking the groundwater from the bore water. And so people traditionally would collect water once it had seeped up from the groundwater to the surface. And even if it might have had this, you know, there's also fresh springs and things like that, but there was places where the water would seep up and it might have the appearance of being not as like clean or clear, but it just had some of the minerals that had accumulated from the way that it seeped up to the surface. And so people would drink that water and it was very healthy because it, you know, then their body was also composed of the minerals of that place, of that country. And, you know, through doing that, you harmonize your material body with the country that you're in. And then, you know, Wajalas came and they start digging bores because they, you know, and say, oh, this is better, it's more efficient, it's like technological advancement. But really all you're doing is you're bypassing that whole process of allowing the water to wash up through the earth, and then you're just sucking it straight past. And so the cultural values that are associated with that are impatience and greed and trying to bring it, you know, and so there is this relationship there with time. So how we culturally relate to water is how we, and place is how we culturally relate to time. And what you said about, you know, 200 years, like that's, yeah, that's that scope that we need to think about as people who are responding to, I think people talk about seven generations as kind of influence to this kind of moment, and then thinking about things for seven generations afterwards. But we don't, like you're saying, with those different governments, no one wants to take responsibility for that. They pass it on because it's taking responsibility is hard. No easy solutions, I don't think.
Thank you all so much for that conversation. I know it's come at a challenging time in not only in Australia but globally. And I really appreciate all of your input and for contributing to this conversation. I think there's, a long way to go. But if we can slowly start to implement a cultural change and respect and acknowledge Indigenous traditional values, understand that traditional knowledge is a science, then, hopefully we can make positive progress. Could we please have a big round of applause for our speakers?
You've been listening to an M-Pavilion podcast recorded on the lands of the Eastern Kulin Nation. For more, visit our archive at mpavilion.org and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.